The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading from Good Old Days magazine. Since school has started back, I want to share with you some stories that our readers have submitted about their school experiences. And the first one is Grandma's Superstition Paid Off. I never wanted summer to end. The back-to-school ads that started showing up in newspapers and storefronts in late July seemed like personal assaults. Going back to school meant an earlier bedtime, no more trips to the lake, and homework. But once those last days of August rolled around, there was nothing to do but resolve myself to the inevitable and embrace the few good things that occurred prior to that first day of school. One good thing was the purchase of a new nifty notebook, and the other good thing was a trip to the nearby Robert Hall clothes store. Nifty notebooks were popular in the 1960s, and fortunately, our local drugstore, Blake's Rexall Drugs, carried them. They were slim and cool-looking and came in various colors. The one I remember most was sky blue. The coolness factor was in its design, as the paper loaded from the top, so of course another purchase of special two-punch paper was necessary. It also had a built-in plastic pencil holder that clicked shut with a magnet. I loved the sound of that click, so crisp and confident. The brand new plastic smell of the notebook inspired hopes of doing better in all my classes, of finishing my homework on time, and of staying organized. There were no lists generated by the teachers at my elementary school requesting specific supplies, such as a certain type of tape or tissues or colored pencils. So having procured just the right notebook of my choice, it was on to the next step. School clothes. Robert Hall clothing stores were popular in upstate New York, and one was located just a few miles away in Auburn, New York. The chain started as a single store in Waterbury, Connecticut in 1937 and grew to over 350 stores across the country over the next several decades. I remember their ads on TV featuring blackbirds on a telephone wire singing about low prices. There never was a Robert Hall in the flesh. Its founder, Jacob Swab, made up the meaningless moniker. Mr. Swab's vision of offering affordable clothing was a precursor of the big box concept that is so popular today. The no-frills atmosphere both inside and outside the stores kept the overhead low so savings could be passed on to the customer. As a child, I knew none of this. I simply knew that my mom and I would come away with several new outfits each year that would alleviate my grief at the passing of summer. On a Sunday morning, a few weeks before the start of third grade, a ladybug landed on my dress as I was walking down the steps of our church with my grandmother in Port Byron, New York. Grandma was delighted by this and told me that if a ladybug landed on your clothing, you would soon receive a new piece of that clothing. New shoes if it landed on your sneakers, new shorts if it landed there, and so on. Grandma had a lot of fun superstitions. A piece of silverware accidentally dropped on the floor meant company was coming. Bread crust would make your hair grow. An itchy wound meant it was healing. I never bought the one about watermelon seeds growing in my stomach if I swallowed them. Before we reached the car, a second ladybug landed on my dress. I was so excited. I ran to my friend Debbie, who was ahead of us on the sidewalk, and told her my good news. Two new dresses. She was going into the fourth grade and had no delusions about ladybugs and their magical bestowals. I was a little hurt, but I still believed. The following week, Mom and I made our outing to Robert Hall, and this time Grandma came with us. We picked out a few new skirts to replace the ones whose hems could not be let down any farther, a few blouses to match, and a new dress. I had my eye on a second dress that I liked even more, but Mom said it was too much to buy at once and that we could put it on layaway for a few weeks. I reluctantly agreed, and Grandma said she would take it up to the counter and fill out the layaway form while Mom and I finished up. Of course, she bought the dress for me instead, but I didn't know this until we got the bags home. Nifty notebooks were a passing fad, and I don't remember if mine helped me stay organized or made me a better student. I don't remember what either of those two new dresses looked like, but I do remember my grandmother's delight at making her ladybug superstition come true. And this article was submitted by Andrea Kilmer Mann. Our next article is titled Building a School in 1957, and this is submitted by Ruth Harrington. In the 1956-57 school year, as a sophomore at Helix High School in La Mesa, California, I enjoyed being a member of the Flag Corps. We marched in many parades, but I especially enjoyed being part of the halftimes at football games, being in the middle of everything on the football field. We practiced with the band after school on weekdays. Then I walked 3 miles home over the Massachusetts Avenue Hill in Lemon Grove. It was a long walk, which built stamina. In the spring of 1957, we were informed that a new high school was being built in Spring Valley on Sweetwater Road. It was to be called Mount McGill High School. Since my family lived in Lemon Grove, some distance from both Helix High and the soon-to-be Mount McGill High, I was given a choice of which school to attend. My parents influenced my decision, I later realized, because although the new school was much farther away, it would have bus service, which Helix did not. Once the choice was made, I was locked in. Then we learned that the proposed bus service was canceled. When I was beginning 11th grade in September 1957, the new school was too far for walking, so I was allowed to drive to school with my new driver's license. Dad worked second shift at Ryan Aeronautical in San Diego, so I had to be home on time with the car. It was a busy year for timing and adjusting schedules. Classes at Mount McGill began in September 1957, even though the school was still under construction. We had classrooms, but there were no bathrooms, only porta-potties, also called Casey's. Sidewalks were not yet installed. There was no landscaping and no paved parking, just lots of mud. We walked carefully, but even without all the amenities in place, classes continued. Several pictures of those conditions were included in the first annual of 1958. There was no cafeteria, no auditorium, no football field, and no gymnasium. Plans were made for alternative PE classes. I remember playing basketball and horseshoes. I won first place. Who knew? For a couple of months in the spring, we were bused daily to the municipal pool in La Mesa for swimming classes. The schedule was tight, but it worked. Then finally, the gymnasium was finished. Freshmen, sophomore, junior, and senior students from Helix High and Grossmont High merged together to create a cohesive student body at Mount McGill High. There was very little rivalry at the time, and we all lived in Lemon Grove anyway. It was determined that we would be known as the Mount McGill Matadors, with a Spanish theme. The sports program began, a marching band was formed, the drill team performed with fans instead of pom-poms. Members of the two former flag corps merged and learned to twirl matador capes instead of flags. The innovations were exciting and impressive. By the end of that first school year, in June 1958, we had become a unified student body of about 1,800 students who worked together. My senior year in June 1959 brought the school's second graduation ceremony, which was held with pride on the grounds of our new school. The memories of that unique time of sharing in the making of our school history have remained with me through the years. The last school story I want to share with you is submitted by Terry Mortar, and it's titled Back to School Preparations. When I think of my earliest school days, I vividly recall the anticipation of preparing for each new school year. My older sister Cindy and I grew up in Orange, California during the 1960s and 70s. We were 2 years apart in age, which meant we attended the same campuses more years than not. Gearing up for the next grade level was exciting, especially during our elementary school years. Summer breaks were a full 3 months back then, so we were more than ready to go back to school when September rolled around. I remember how awkward a pencil felt in my hand on the first day of school, as I'd had no reason to pick up a writing implement of any kind during the summer. First on our agenda was a few days spent with our grandparents toward the end of each summer. This was an annual tradition which culminated with Grandma returning home with us for a few days of school shopping. Back then, paper, pencils, crayons, and erasers were provided in the classrooms, so our shopping merely consisted of purchasing the proper school attire. There was a dress code that was strictly adhered to. Backpacks were not necessary either, since all our supplies remained in our lift-top desk. Grandma loved being included in our preparations, treating each of us to a new outfit, a new pair of functional shoes, or a new lunchbox. One year, she and Mom also surprised us with a day at Disneyland to commemorate the end of summer. I have fond memories of one particular new outfit and one awesome lunchbox. Those were purchased for my second grade school year. Girls weren't permitted to wear pants to school until the late 1960s, so dresses it was. For those of us who frequented the monkey bars at recess, this required wearing shorts underneath. That year, Cindy and I got brown faux leather outfits, a skirt for my sister, and a jumper for me. We thought we were too cool for school and our leather wear. We also chose matching metal lunchboxes, replete with a thermos and magnetic markers for the game board on the back of the lunchbox. The theme of the box was Campus Queen. The lid was trimmed in pink, and the graphics boasted a high school couple dressed for prom. It was very girly. The sides were also adorned with additional young ladies wearing the styles and beehive or bouffant hairdos of the day. Wow, we sure hit the jackpot with those lunchboxes. We felt like we just might be the envy of the lunch tables. With our school shopping complete, there was one last detail, or rite of passage, you might say, and that was the long-awaited posting of which teacher we would be assigned for the upcoming year. Our moms would receive word of the date of the posting, which was displayed in a glass-enclosed marquee on the front office building. It was such a big deal getting down to the school on that day, crowding and elbowing one another to catch a glimpse of what our next year would entail. We loved reconnecting with kids we hadn't seen all summer, and we were mutually impressed with the changes we saw in one another. Teacher and classroom location were not of primary importance. New classmates were. One exception was the rare occasion when I'd been assigned a teacher that had previously been my sister's. Cindy was a fun kid, a model student, and well-liked by her teachers. It was a plus to ride on her coattails for sure. Back in the 1960s, most moms were homemakers. We lived in a tight-knit cul-de-sac with lots of kids in our age range, and all our mothers were at home full-time. Even though this was the norm, I felt blessed that my mom was there when we left for school and when we returned home. I was a talker and often wanted to share my day with her. It was a more innocent time back then, safe enough for us to walk the quarter mile to and from school. And we weren't loaded down with homework back then. We completed our studies at school and were able to just be kids in the afternoons. We spent all our spare time playing outside right up until dinner time. The same was true for weekends, except we played outside after dinner as well until the streetlights came on. Just as public school was for learning, I also gleaned life lessons from the school of Grandma. A couple of her most often used sayings remain with me today. When offering us kids snacks or treats, she'd say with a grin, "Have a lot. Take two." She instilled in me that two of anything was more than enough and that moderation is a good thing. She was very thrifty, but we never felt cheated. Grandma had four children and eight grandchildren, so she was no stranger to child psychology. When addressing misbehavior, she favored diversion over discipline. She believed that children naturally choose right behaviors when diverted to better options. Grandma had the patience of a saint and was always about building us up. My sister passed away last year. Writing these memories of our shared experiences is a tribute to her, to lessons learned from Grandma, to the gift of a stay-at-home mom, and to the best of school times back in the good old days. The next story I have to share with you is titled Driving Test Do-Overs, and this is by Joan Kidd. In 1965, when I was 17 and a half years old, during the months of June through August, I managed to fail three driving tests in the Jamaica neighborhood in Queens, New York. Given the brief time period I tried to get my license, I might have set a new failure record. I had to take the test in quick succession because I was leaving in September to attend Boston University. And the idea was that I would have my driver's license before I left, since I wouldn't be in New York to renew my learner's permit when it expired. Driving test number one. I drove to the testing site with my father in the passenger seat. At the location, the cars were lined up bumper to bumper on a narrow side street that ran parallel to a highway. After one car left, the car behind it would pull forward. During that interval, the tester would get into the next car that was set to leave and check over the required documents to make sure everything was in order and be ready to go when the car in front pulled out. The tester approached my car. He was a big, muscular, mean-looking guy, at least 6 feet tall, swarthy, with slicked back, very black hair, and reflective sunglasses that prevented me from being able to see his eyes. In his spiffy, perfectly pressed navy blue uniform with shiny gold buttons and equally shiny black boots, he looked to me like every bad cop in every bad cop movie. I honestly don't remember what happened except that he scared me half to death, and I was a nervous wreck taking the test. I was totally traumatized. Back then, the results came by mail in about a week or so. I failed. Okay, it happened. No big deal. I just quickly made an appointment for another test, and I kept practicing driving. Driving test number two. The tester approached my car. It was the same bad cop, complete with reflective sunglasses from driving test number one. My father and I looked at each other and just started to laugh. We couldn't believe it. To me, it was like something out of the Twilight Zone. All I remember is that I giggled inappropriately from time to time during the test while the bad cop tester sat beside me, stone-faced. Notification of failure number two arrived in the mail. Another appointment was made. My father commented that he wished you could still bribe the testers by giving them an envelope with $10 tip in it, like he did when my mother got her license. Driving test number 3. Well, at least it wasn't the bad cop for the third time. The guy looked normal. He was a small man with thinning hair, wearing a less intimidating khaki uniform and wireless glasses that weren't reflective. He looked like he could have been a high school math or science teacher. The tester quickly perused my documentation and said, "Okay, go ahead and pull out." That's when the problem arose. As I said, the cars were lined up, bumper to bumper. On the right was the curb, so I had to pull out to the left. There couldn't have been more than a couple of inches between the car in front of me and the one behind me. I was boxed in, and it was taking the car in front of me a long time to get moving. It was still there when my tester told me to pull out. There was no way I could do it without going back and forth who knows how many times, and I could still end up tapping the fenders of the cars ahead and behind me and or bumping into the curb. What in the world was this tester guy thinking? So I stalled. Our little question and response conversation went something like this. Me. Now? Tester, yes, pull out now. Me, now? Before the car in front of me goes? Tester, yes, now. Me, now? You don't want me to wait until the car in front pulls out? Tester, no. Me, really, right now? Tester, yes, now. Finally, the car in front of me left, so off I went. Needless to say, I failed, probably before I even began driving, and by more points than I had in the prior 2 bad cop tests. I finally got my driver's license when I was about 21 and living in Philadelphia with my husband, who was getting a doctorate from the University of Pennsylvania. It was an easy test, given in a big parking lot with plenty of room between a series of orange cones that are usually used to mark places where road work is being done and a lane is closed. All I had to do was drive through the cones without knocking any over. There was no parallel parking and no traffic. It was a cakewalk, or should I say a cake drive. When we moved back to New York, they had one of those reciprocal deals where if you already had a license from certain states, you could just exchange it for a New York license. Luckily, Pennsylvania was one of those states. To this day, I doubt I could ever have passed a New York City driving test. The next story I have to share with you is submitted by Leanne Murphy, and it's titled Granny's Not-So-Secret Cookie Jar. My granny's kitchen was our family haven, a place where 3 generations gathered to drink strong coffee, munch on a cookie, or enjoy granny's signature pot roast. One countertop held her 1950s Cro-Max silver aluminum canister set. Each black lid proclaimed what was inside: flour, sugar, coffee, and tea. But at Granny's house, the flour canister held Oreo cookies. Each grandchild knew the secret, but we never grabbed a cookie without asking. As I grew older, I often helped Granny cook. I doled out ingredients from the other canisters as needed and helped bake biscuits or a cake. After Granny passed away during my college years, I inherited many of her kitchen items. After I married and my husband and I bought our permanent home, I unpacked and found the canisters. The old canisters have aged well, and I use them daily. Unlike my grandmother, I keep flour in the one designated for flour. I have a few other items from Granny's kitchen, but my favorites remain the simplest and most serviceable, those 1950s canisters that held cookies and a heaping measure of love. And our next story is submitted by Diane Marshall, and it's titled Tremendous Art. My mom grew up during the Depression and was quite skilled when it came to crafting. There wasn't anything she couldn't create or make into something beautiful. She quilted, crocheted, knitted, embroidered, and did macrame. Her crafting also expanded to include nature art. Late one autumn afternoon in 1970, I had just returned home after visiting a friend. As I entered through the sliding glass door into our modest living room, I spotted a long tree branch. It wasn't lying on the floor, but rather it was hanging on our living room wall. Mom had been in one of her creative moods earlier that day and had gathered a tree branch that had fallen in our yard during a recent storm. It was about 5 feet long with multiple tiny branches extending here and there. She had spray painted it a glossy dark brown that was almost black in color. A few rubbery grape clusters were hung on several limbs, and a couple of feathery faux birds were perched on a limb or two. Way up high over to one side hung a huge hornet's nest, about the size of two footballs side by side. I could hardly believe what I was seeing. All I could think about was how she managed to collect a hornet's nest, and I wondered, where in the world did all the hornets go that lived in it? With my mouth wide open in amazement, I turned to my mom. The look on her face was priceless as she beamed with joy. She was so proud of her new masterpiece. Mom's tree branch art remained on our living room wall for many years. It was truly one of a kind. Here are things my parents used to say. Sandy Elliott said that her grandmother, who raised her, would get up in the morning and stretch, and then she'd say, "I could stretch a mile if I didn't have to walk back." When William Whitmore's father-in-law saw something out of the ordinary, he would say, "Well, don't that beat a frog a-walkin'." And Carol A. noted that when she was a little girl, her father had a favorite saying whenever they stopped at a red light. He'd say, "Wink your green eye, you little redhead." Here's some flashback fun for you. In 1955, besides typical white kitchen appliances, General Electric started offering appliances in an array of colors: green, brown, yellow, navy blue, and pink. And in the late 1960s, teenagers could decorate their rooms with colorful psychedelic pop art posters by artists like Peter Max that cost only a couple of dollars each. These posters would feature names of rock bands like Jefferson Airplane and The Doors. We've run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it, and I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And that number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.